Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And good morning. It is the Boomer and the Babe Show here on Blog Talk Radio. This is Pete Peters. We're coming to you live from the Valley View Community Food Bank offices and offices also of Feeding Arizona, where the food for the participants is always free. If you're looking for a really neat 501c3 to make your donations to, contact Valley View Community Food Bank. Jesse Ramirez is the executive director and founder of the food bank, and he would be more than happy to talk to you and discuss with you what his needs are, food-wise, financial, and volunteer. So whatever it is that you'd like to donate to the food bank would be greatly appreciated, and no donation is too small. It's Monday, March 26, 2012, and we're here at the studio with a great guest today, and we're going to be talking to him very shortly. A couple of pieces of business I want to take care of before we go off and talk with our guest. One of our previous guests, Jack Job, is a preparedness person, and Jack Job is going to be on the National Geographic History Channel when they're starting to do their things about being prepared and preparedness, and he's on starting tomorrow, Tuesday, and you can check that out. Check your local listings for the preparedness features on the History Channel, National Geographic History Channel. So look for Jack Job. That's number one. And number two, at 12 o'clock today, starting a new show here on the Boomer the Babe Network, it is all about globalization. It's Go Global Fast. It's with Dr. Tiara Kobayeva and Deborah Brown. Deborah will be actually in studio and co-hosting the show with Dr. Kobayeva, talking about globalization and all the things of interest and people that are interested in being more global with regard to everything that they're doing, including business. So that'll be an interesting show, and that'll be a regular Monday show at 12 o'clock, Go Global Fast. Well, to our guest today, we have a gentleman with us today who has a rich history in investigative work. His name is Mike Kiger, and he has a website called missing.com. He's been an investigator for many years, and if I got that wrong, I'm sure he'll correct me, and I hope he does. But at any rate, welcome to the show, Mike. How are you today?
I'm fine, sir. Thank you, Pete. And as far as the website, it is Missing Inc. It's missinginc.com, missinginc.com.
I forgot the ink part. I should have remembered the ink part. But missinginc.com is the website, and I know you've got a lot of things we're going to be talking about today, but before we do, if Deborah were here in studio, she would ask you for your two-minute movie. By that, she would mean, you know, what is a Mike Kiger, where does he hail from, and how did he, what does his background look like prior to doing doing what you're doing now? I guess we're going to investigate you for a minute, so you can be a self-investigator. Tell us whatever you like.
All right, well, that's fine. I always had interest as a kid as far as being a private investigator, as far as reading the Hardy Boy books and Nancy Drew books, and just followed it on through in that regards with it, and did time in service from about 72 to 79, got out of service, and managed to get 2 degrees, and in the last of my degrees, I started my own business as far as a private investigator with $100 in my pocket, and 30 years later, I'm still in business as a PI, and I work in the Portland, Oregon area, but I do cases on both a national and international basis.
So as a PI, what special training have you had to have, or did
well,
you have? become a PI.
What's interesting in respect to when I went in the business, I'm an unusual animal because I literally have learned my craft from the street, or from, as some people would say, from the gutter up. Most of the people that are in this business are some kind of retired law enforcement, either federal or government, and they are trained a very different way in regards to approaching people and witnesses than what you are when you learn, basically learn from the street and learn how to deal with people. And so it's quite interesting because when you have a law enforcement background, you're used to going up to a door and having somebody automatically, immediately being willing to talk to you because of your credentials and that type of thing. When you're a private investigator and you go up and knock, and they can tell you to get lost real easily. And so you have to find other ways of how to approach people and how to deal with people. And I ended up with an associate's in criminal justice and a bachelor's in poli-sci. And then in 1998, the state of Oregon decided that we as PIs need to be licensed. Up until then, anybody could come up here and be a PI. And since that time, we are licensed. We renew every 2 years. And then we're also required to have 32 hours of continuing education every 2 years.
It's nice to know that there is some sort of a licensing process, I would imagine, or some sort of regulations, if you will, on what you can and can't do and what you have to know. If you were to believe the movies, I guess you could say that private investigators are portrayed in many cases in a less than wonderful manner. Is that safe?
That's safe to say, and in that respect with it. And the easiest way that I can compare it is because a lot of times when people see me or ask me about what I do, I try to explain to them I'm not Rockford. I'm not crashing my car every week because my insurance company wouldn't be too happy with me. And as far as all the beautiful women that he keeps seeing to run into, I have run into a few, but they're not as consistent as what Jim Rockford seems to get.
That's consistent. I like that. That's very good. And possibly not as willing either. So, so is would you consider it the way it's obviously? We only know the way it's portrayed. I mean, and right. So much of that, of anything that's on the airwaves or in the movies or whatever, is right. Portrayed one way, and at least usually has to do with a certain degree of glamour and glitz and excitement and adventure. How often is that really the case with you, with a PI in general?
Well, it depends on what you're doing. It can. I do have some of that, and in respect to the fact of the type of cases that I deal with, and every case is different because everyone takes a twist or a turn that of not where you start out at, not where you end up. And in that respect, with it. But what people fail to realize is that there's roughly 5,000 lawyers, I think, in Oregon, and there's as many different PIs or specialties as there are, say, per se, of the amount of lawyers that's in Oregon. It doesn't mean that there's one per lawyer, but there's just so many different areas that we work in. There's some investigators that specialize in nothing but workman's compensation, some that specialize in nothing but criminal defense, some that specialize in nothing but, you know, medical malpractice in that aspect of it. There's some like myself, I specialize in adoption cases where I work for adoptees and birth parents. I do everything from aggravated murder to adoptions. And I cover a wide variety and choose to do that. But like I said, there's others that find a special niche, and that's all that they do. And you don't necessarily see that with what's on TV, because on TV they're compacted into 60 minutes, and so they're showing a jack of all trades, and we do have to be a jack of all trades. But when you find what you really enjoy, you stay with it.
Is it safe to say that a lot of your work is paperwork and tracking down public records and files and and things like that. Is that a safe assessment?
That is a safe assessment from what I do, because again, I get involved with where cases, like I said, I'm not doing surveillance, I'm not doing domestics or workman's comp, I'm working for connecting adoptees up or birth parents up, I'm working from the standpoint that I get involved in high-end financial investigations, which is a lot of record tracking. I get involved with doing criminal defense cases where you're defending someone or defending someone's life. And so quite often, a lot of the times on that is going through records and going through the discovery that's being presented from the other side, and then going out and interviewing people. And then once you've done your interviews, then compiling those in a report format for the attorney.
Is part of your task, part of your duties, is it to testify in court, or is it just to give a deposition? How much of which or either of those do you do at all?
I have testified in court before on cases. I've not necessarily had to give depositions, but that can be part of it. Our product is protected. When we're hired directly from the attorney, then our work product is protected as far as the attorney relationship with myself. If I'm working directly for a client without the attorney being in there, then yes, my records, my reports can be subpoenaed. But otherwise, it's protected from the other side. So I don't often see court as many times as some people would think. The stock and trade of our business is that most of us are more used to working in the background and in the shadows, which is where we prefer to stay, versus being on the in the spotlight or being directly on in the judgment in regards to the fact of the witness stand.
How is it that you say you work predominantly in adoption cases?
Right.
How is it that you came to that specialty, and was there something that pushed you over the edge with regard to, this is really where I want to concentrate?
Well, I had a client that had asked me if I could do one because I had never done one before, and I come from an upper middle class family, was never adopted, so I had no real reason to go in that direction until the client had asked me. I did the case, was successful, and just the universe made sure I started getting more of them. And so I have had a real compassion, a real feel for the adoptees, and enjoy those cases. And they're not necessarily always large moneymaker cases for me. It's the other things that I do help pay for my work that I do in respect to the effect of the adoption cases, but it's something that I enjoy. And the easiest way that I can encapsulate this is that most men, when they turn 45 or 50, they have a what they call a midlife crisis. And a lot of men, they end up trading in their wife for two 20-year-olds or for a Corvette. In my particular case, I looked around at the age of 50 and looked to see what my legacy would be if I had left the world tomorrow. And I finally determined that my adoption work is my legacy, because it will change many lives and many families for years after I'm gone. And to me, I feel like that's a very good legacy to leave.
And change many of them, I would imagine, for the better, if they're looking to find siblings or adopted parents or natural parents or whatever.
Right.
So it probably has a lot of reward to it.
And it does. And what we're seeing, because it's interesting with your program being the boomer and the babe, is that the baby boomers right now are getting a slap in the face or upside the head, because they have changed everything as they have gone through in aging because of their numbers. Now Mother Nature's saying, knock, knock, I'm here, and you need to start getting your affairs in order. And so many of the boomers are being faced with getting their wills, their trusts, their pensions in order, also what they want to leave. And this is having an effect and will continue to have an effect for the next 19 years, because you've got 10,000 boomers a day turning 65 for the next upcoming 19 years. And they are looking the fact of either seeing about leaving something in their will, maybe for the child that they adopted out, or they're finding out that they want to make a connection with this child to see, and as they're no longer a child, they would be an adult by now in many cases, to see how they turned out. And sometimes they want contact, sometimes they don't. There's other times that they will make the arrangements to their will, and all of a sudden something happens, and you have a family and two natural children there, and they read Papa's will, and lo and behold, they find out they have a half-brother or sister that is now entitled to one-third of the estate. And so that in itself is creating a lot of different problems and dilemmas. So there's a variation, but it's definitely Mother's Nature way of saying you need to get things in order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, come over here when I smack you. How often is it the case that you find the, for lack of a better word, the missing sibling or missing daughter or son,
right?
And they don't want to have any part or anything to do with the parent.
Well, this has been very seldom that I've had that in the 20 years that I've done adoption work. I can only remember about two cases that I had where it was more the birth parent that wasn't necessarily wanting something to do with the adoptee. Most often the birth parents are thrilled in the fact of having them recontact them. And then also it's from the standpoint too that there's several levels of it, because there can be one level of full contact, there can be one level of just contact by phone or voice. Mail. There's a level of just the fact of by letters, or in the fact that they just simply want they want medical information, and it's left at that, because a lot of these women are being faced with the fact that they were told that these records would never be opened. I know in Oregon that was what they were told. Oregon passed a law, the age of 21, people can have their records opened. And so that's a whole different situation. And even if somebody has their record open, that's only half the battle, is because the fact is that they don't know about how to go about searching for someone. And it's not only the birth mothers that are being affected, but so are the birth fathers, because in some cases you have fathers that didn't know that they were a father for one reason or another. You have the one particular case that I can remember, and I felt very bad for the gentleman, but I called, found the birth mother and called her, and she essentially told me, she said, you know, look, he needs to, you know, we were both young and foolish, it was a mistake, he needs to get on with his life. And I reported it back to the client, and the, you know, client says, wait a week. I called her back, and at the time, when I first talked to her, she says, well, you're lucky that I answered the phone and not my, you know, not my husband. And then when I called her back a week later, she professed to not know anything at all of what I was talking about or who I was talking about. And but to turn to find out, this woman had a husband. She had three daughters, and she had told the husband, but she had never told the three daughters that they had a half sibling. And this was not the birth father that she was married to. So she took a very cold attitude, but it's her loss, because her son was very successful, did very well for himself.
It's all about, in some cases, I would imagine, what goes around comes around.
Yes.
I mean, it will come back to bite you in the backside, won't it? I mean,
yes. Very much so.
I imagine you see that a fair amount of time. Is that correct?
I do see that, and it's you know, it'll come back to bite you, or what you reap you sow. And you may have made made a mistake or something in that regards, whether it's a one night stand, whether it was a rape, but that individual still deserves to know something about their background and their history. And that's what a lot of these adoptees want to know, is that they want history. They're coming of an age where they've engaged or they're getting married and they want to have children. And so they want to know what they can have, what they can find out. It goes both ways. I have a client that, and this is a good story for you, but my client found out at the age of 65 that he was adopted.
Wow.
And because of the passing of one of his relatives, and what he found out was that he was actually raised by his grandparents without realizing it, that his brother was his birth father.
Oh, my gosh.
And his older brother. And they put me to work to find her, and I found his mother. And she's still alive and well and at 91 years old and very much cognizant. And so he was thrilled to death. But to imagine to go all your life and think that, well, you know, that you were what your family was, and at age 65 to get this kind of a shock.
So he had an older brother, and it was actually his father.
Mm-hmm. Because what had happened was that he had gotten involved with a gal and didn't marry her, or she didn't marry him for whatever reason, and then she was pregnant, had the child, and so the family took him, his own family then raised him. Which would have, like, technically his grandparents raised him without realizing it, thinking that they were his parents.
Wow. What a story.
Yeah.
Are you putting all this stuff in a book?
Well, that's what several people have told me, and I do have files that I've saved or held on to that. You know, well, we'll see at some point in time. Right now, I just have so many different ones coming my direction, and it's all I can do to keep them up.
How many cases do you typically handle? What kind of caseload do you normally have? I don't know.
Well, it can vary, but usually, anywhere from five or six at a time, just depending on what it is, and that is a combination of private clients, attorneys, and in other areas that I'm involved in. So it can vary. You don't necessarily get into this profession to be rich, even though there's ones that make less than I do, some that make more, but you get into this profession because of the fact that you believe in and like to help people.
I would imagine that there is a high percentage of confidentiality, isn't there, in all of this? I mean, you really have to be able to keep it buttoned up, I guess, is a nice way to say it. In other words, you can't go writing too many books and using the right names and the real names and so on.
Well, that's true to a large degree, but yet there's some that do want their stories told. I was fortunate enough to be involved with a book called Mama, Is That You? And it was written by Cynthia McGregor, and I was the chief investigator and researcher on it. And each chapter in it is a different story on an adoption case. And many of my successful ones were in there because the clients agreed to want to have their story told. And there's some in there that the birth parents have done the search on their own, or the adoptee have done the search on their own, but they agreed to want to have their story told and not have it hidden. And so that went well, and it is available online. And so it's up to the individual as to what they want put out. But as far as what you're asking, yes, it's called compartmentization, and I do that a lot.
Yeah. What is the case? Is there one or two cases that you can readily point to and say that was one of the more satisfying cases that I've done, and what was the reason for it? If you can relate that.
Well, obviously, the gentleman at 65 years of age, it was
right.
I changed his life completely. And, you know, I had another one that I had to end up going and having surgery in the hospital. And the interviewing nurse that took me into the hospital, she says, when she found out what I did, she says, oh, she said, I'm an adoptee. I'd like to talk to you. Well, at the time, I really wasn't in too much concern about talking to anybody. And I said, well, call me in 2 weeks and after I get out of the hospital. And so she did, and I went to work for her. And come to find out that I did track down her father and found I'd missed him by a year. He had passed away a year prior. But I found out that he had only married this one woman, and they in turn had something like 6 kids, and as it turns out, they completely accepted my client into the family, and not only and my client's son, and given the fact that he had only been gone a year, they actually considered this a blessing, not only a blessing but a message from him for her to end up contacting them within a year of his passing. So, and they still keep in touch on a regular basis, go back and forth. One lives on one side of the country, one on the other, but they go back and forth and see each other.
That's a great story. How many of your clients still keep in touch with you or you with them?
There's several that do in that regards with it because they just they're happy with the job, and the utmost comment that they pay, that they compliment that they pay to me, is when they refer somebody else to me, which happens a lot in that regards. With that, I may not necessarily hear from the client for 6 months or a year, but all of a sudden I get a referral, and they say, "Well, so and so referred me." Well, that's the highest compliment that I can be paid.
Sure, sure, absolutely. What is it? What is it that draws these people to, I mean, we've already discussed the fact that it might be some health questions or want to know for health reasons and so on. But is there anything else that really draws them to want to find more of their history? Or I'm fishing around for the question here. I mean, I know that people want to know what's going on, that's going on in their lives before, where they come from, and so on and so forth. But on the other side of the coin, there's probably people that really want to know, but they just say, well, I really don't care until something comes up. Is that, how frequently does that happen like that? I mean, there's just something, what is it that pushes them over the top? Maybe that's the better question.
Well, it can be, it's a two-part answer to your question. It can be anything from obviously the medical issues to also things from, well, where did I get my blue eyes when everybody else in my family has hazel eyes? In that respect, in other words, did I get those blue eyes from my mother, from my father? Where did I get those? What's my background as far as the fact of, is there anybody that was really notable or successful in my birth parents' life that I can be proud of from that aspect of it, and not only from the fact of the birth mother and the birth father, but you have to understand is that this is like a rock in a pond, and that it has a ripple effect. So when somebody goes to contact their birth mother or birth father, they're also establishing a relationship that may come about as far as their grandparents, with any step-siblings they may have, with any cousins, any aunts and uncles. So there's a lot more relationships that are involved versus just the main two. The other triggers that may be for it is from the standpoint when they have their adoptive parents pass away, one or the other, then they had talked about doing it, but maybe didn't do anything because they didn't want to upset the apple cart as far as their parents and their adopted parents. And now that they're both deceased, they feel like they can go through and pursue this to find out about their own heritage. And then it's also from the standpoint that if they're an only child and they've lost a mother and then they lose their adoptive father within a year or something, it's like all of a sudden now they're all alone in the world. And so they want to look at that heritage. They want to see if there's anybody else out there before, you know, before it's their turn.
As it relates to the baby boomer cohort, how many boomers come to you and say, you know, I think I might have bothered a child somewhere in the 60s. Is there anything that you can do to check that out for me? Does that happen very often?
It does happen in that regards with it. It does. And we can do, we would treat it just like any other case in the fact that I sit down and I have a list of questions that I go through with my clients that I ask them. And if they, if they don't give me reasonable answers or the answers that I need and I respect with it, then I politely refuse to take the case because I get as much as I can from them, but it's not just them giving me information and writing me a check and sending me on my way. There's a lot more that's involved in it that I do as far as follow-up with the contact and that type of thing and things that I lay out. And so if they're willing to agree to that, then we'll do that. But as far as, yes, those happen. I mean, I even have a client that asked me to locate his daughter. I did. And the divorce was nasty, and the mother raised the girl, and she really doesn't want anything to do with him, but she's had a child herself, and so what the client has asked is that I keep the file open so that at such time that something happens to him, he will have it in his will, in his estate, that they are to contact me, and then I'm to make an effort to contact her because I have her contact information, but he doesn't have it, and that's what she's asked. And so that's another way of doing it is that I have it, then once something happens, then that he's able to leave something for her, be it a letter, be it a sum of money, whatever it is.
Yeah, your natural father passed and has mentioned you in his will, and he has left you X.
Right.
Whatever it might be.
Right.
And then you are the holder of that information, and it's in your possession until such time as he passes.
Right. Right.
Wow, that's interesting. I hadn't even ever thought of that that aspect of what you might do. Is that something that happens frequently, or is that something that is a little bit of an unusual request?
That was an unusual request given this client, you know, for this particular client, but it's something that can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then in turn, I have to make, I've made arrangements so that if something would happen to me, that I'll have another investigator that I know that will take that file and hold on to it until such time that he's notified. So I'm making plans for within myself because the fact that nobody, you know, you can walk out and get hit crossing the street, and but this way I know that the client's wishes will be honored.
That's another point that I would never ever thought of. But then again, I suppose, you know, it's like that definition of the best friend of the world is that if you die, the first thing they do is they go and they scrub your computer for you. It really has the information really has to be recoverable somehow, somewhere. Otherwise, that trail will be lost with your passing.
Right.
And no way related to the people other than through that file.
Right.
Wow, that's very interesting. What other kind of little quirky thing? I would call that a little quirky way of a quirky thing that you do. Are there any other things like that, or not necessarily like it, but other little quirky things that that you have to be considerate of in your work like that?
Well, that's just part of it as far as the fact of the privacy issue of. Taking it a step further to make sure that everything is honored for what the clients are wanting, and it doesn't matter whether it's criminal defense or whether it's, you know, adoptions. It's the same thing. It's just, you know, a little bit different that you have to look for. I get involved in a wide variety. I was told long ago that I would help write a book, and I blew it off when I was young and saying, okay, English was not my forte in high school, but and as it turns out, I'm now a published author on several different fronts, and I've written an article on adoption investigations that's been published in 5 trade publications in the UK. I've written an article on elder abuse that's being put into another book, as a chapter in another book. I've helped edit a book on adoptions. And so I've ended up in the publishing end of it, whether I wanted to or not.
A second career unintended.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the, because all boomers are involved somehow, and I shouldn't say all, but certainly the great majority of boomers are involved somehow with elderly parents. What was the purpose of your article on elder abuse? I say, oh my God, my parents are old was the title of your article. The chapter you wrote, what did that involve, and how did that come to pass?
Well, no, what I wrote was I wrote an article on elder abuse, and there's a lady by the name of Faye LeBeau that did a book that's coming out in June called Oh My God, My Parents Are Old.
Oh, okay.
And she geared it towards the baby boomers from the standpoint that the ones that are on one hand, they're finding that they're getting college kids through college. On the other hand, they're caring for elderly parents. They're in the middle, trying to plan their own retirement. And I happened to write an article on that, and then she liked it and wanted to incorporate it into a chapter in the book. Where it came out of is that I did a case that was basically an estate that was inappropriately taken. There were 3 siblings, and one sibling stole a million-plus estate from her other 2 siblings while at the same time committing elder abuse on her own mother. And it was to the point that it was so horrendous that I really got an education out of it. And then out of that case, I'm involved in a movie production that's being made into a movie. It's based on that case. It's fictional. The story is fictional, but it's based on that case called The Evil Cake Lady. And it has to do with that end of it and the fact of the abuse that's being done. And, again, the baby boomers are going to change this because they've got the voting block. They've got the money. They're going to, no longer you're going to see the elders warehoused in places that are just gray walls. They're going to change how they're housed, the vacation spots that are offered. And I don't mean to be morbid, but they're even going to change the situations with funeral homes and with graveyards, because there's going to be such mass numbers. We had a spokesman that came forth last year that really has shined a spotlight on that, and that's Mickey Rooney. He testified before Congress to the fact of the elder abuse that was done to him from his own stepson. And I mean, it was even to the point where he was down to one pair of shoes. And this is somebody that's was an American icon, still is, and has made a lot of money in the movie industry and should be enjoying a life of pleasure and definitely shouldn't be in a position where he only has one pair of shoes to his name.
What constitutes elder abuse as you've seen it? What are some of the things that are considered to be elder abuse?
Well, elder abuse can be a wide gamut. One of the main things that you will see a lot, and whether it's a child is doing it or whether a situation where you have a caregiver come in, but if you use the term isolation, you look it up to the dictionary, it means to basically you're by yourself. But if you mention that to an attorney that specializes in elder abuse, he's going to understand immediately what that means and what it's about. And because I just schooled a client, I said, you're contesting a trust, you're going to have one attorney for the trust, you're going to have one for the elder abuse. And I said, if you mention the word isolation to the trust attorney, see what he tells you. Client come back and says he blew it off. He says, I mentioned it to the elder abuse attorney, and he knew immediately. And what that amounts to is where you see where the person in question, they have a caregiver or they have a child or somebody that has dollar signs in their eyes, and they start isolating this person. All of a sudden, you don't hear from grandma so often. All of a sudden, the weekly calls have stopped, or the fact that you don't get the birthday card every year from her in that respect with it. Or you call, and while she's sleeping, she can't be, we'll have her call you back, and then she never calls. Well, that's when you need to start looking, because what they're doing is that they're isolating her or him from the people around them that care about them, and so that they're the person that this individual is totally dependent upon, and they're totally the isolator is totally in control of the elder person's situation, to the point it's similar to the Stockholm syndrome. When somebody is kidnapped, and after so long a period of time, they start associating with their kidnapper and defending their kidnapper. Well, when somebody is isolated, after a period of time, they become so dependent upon the person that's isolating them and think that this person is doing so much good for them because of the fact that they're making sure that they get a meal. They're making sure that their bills are paid. Well, it's also a matter of control. And that happens a lot. It happens an awful lot. And because, I mean, I've seen cases where they had an elder person do 3 wills in 2 years. And that's in each case, the value of this, everything that was in the estate ended up changing. To in the last will, it went to one person, and everybody else was out of it.
Wow, that's interesting. How often does that happen?
It happens a lot. It truly happens a lot, from the standpoint that when money's involved, people change or tend to change, and particularly also when it's with caregivers, from the standpoint that you need to have, you need to check on the people that are the caregivers for your elderly parent, whether you're hiring them or whether you're putting them in an assisted living home. If you go and if this person starts saying, well, you know, they abuse me or they treat me badly when you're not here, sometimes that can be, some people will dismiss that as being dementia, but in many cases it's not, and if you're being told that, pick up on the red flag on it. There's things that can be done, and it can be verified. I know I had a particular gentleman told me that he was not a family member, but he would go and see this person, and he kept getting told by this man, well, they abuse me when you're not here. And so what they did was they set it up in such a way that it looked like they had left. They came back in, the family members or whatever came back in and was in the area enough to see it. Then they caught the caregiver red-handed abusing the patient.
Physically abusing.
Yeah. I mean, just basically kind of flipping them around and not, you know, in other words, not giving them as much gentle care as they should have.
Wow.
And so they caught him red-handed, but that's because the family chose to go out of their way to listen to that person versus the fact of saying, well, you know, Uncle's got dementia and doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I know I had a situation before my father passed that he was in a care facility, a nursing home, because he needed to have skilled nursing. And his skin on his body, but primarily his arms, was very, very thin. And he took blood thinners. And they would put, I'm not suggesting that this was intentional abuse, but they would put tape on his arms to hold down some gauze and so on and so forth that he may have hit his arm on the side of the bed or something like that, and the skin would tear.
Right.
Well, then when they tried to take the tape off, they were doing more damage by taking the tape off.
Right.
And I ended up just going up one side, and I mean, I just exploded. I said, "What? You know, I put all this information, and I have this information in this chart. No tape, only use the Coban."
Right.
And I don't know that that was an intentional abuse, but it was certainly negligence. And,
right.
And that the only way I found that was to actually see him personally. And if it had been a case where I and my mother had not been available and Deborah had not been available to see him exactly what was going on there, it never would have been remedied.
Right.
And so you really do need to have, this is another show that we've done, but you need to have an advocate, and you need to have somebody also that is willing to make that notification to someone that there is some form of abuse going on here,
right.
Whether it's intentional or otherwise. At that juncture, it doesn't matter. The fact that it's happening
is enough.
Is enough. It's a short. They were shortcutting the system. It was easier to grab the tape and put it on than it was to go get the roll of Coban. You know.
Right.
It was just that simple. The other thing I'm interested in, as far as this the elder abuse thing is concerned, how often do people think or claim elder abuse and it isn't elder abuse? Does that happen very often?
I haven't seen it that much. It's you have to look at the, like I said, there's some of them that will have dementia, and you have to look at all of that combined and take in the whole picture with it, because I know we're going through a dementia with a family member, and it makes it very, very difficult, because they may not necessarily be happy where they're living. And want to go and live with another family member, but if you look at all of it in respect with it, is that even if you move that individual, it would only take about 2 weeks before that person would be unhappy with the person that they're living with now.
Exactly.
So in essence, it's the dementia, the disease that's talking versus a person that you actually knew, because in essence and the bottom line is that they're not necessarily going to be happy anywhere that they're living. And
well,
so you just...
Yeah. Well, I'm aware of that simply because I have a similar situation myself, and it is definitely the case where no matter where you live, the memory will not return.
Right.
No matter where you live, when you have things that you don't remember doing, you're still going to do things that you don't remember doing. Whether
right.
you're here, there, or anywhere else, that's not going to change. And I'm sorry, and it's heartbreaking, and I'm sorry to see that, but I have to try to point this out, or somebody else has to try to point this out, but it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it doesn't go anywhere. And it's a sad state of affairs where, in reality... it isn't any form of abuse. It's just, as you said, it's not going to be any different anywhere else.
Right. And the person that they're living with can give them the best of care, but just because of the fact that they still want to be independent or be on their own and feel they can be when they can't, they tend to get a little bit grumpy, I guess, is the best way of putting it at times.
Yes.
And it's, you know, nobody... is abusing them, but it's just the situation that they're in is not what they want, but it can't be changed. And all you can do is, even if you have to go through it every week when you see that person with them, is just talk to them gently and say, you know, we went over this, but we'll go over it again. Is it, you know, it wouldn't make any difference even if we moved you.
Well, people are being abused, and they're being abused by their condition.
Right.
Not by where they're living, not by the people that they're living with. They're being abused by the way it has gone for them. That's
yep.
abusing them. That's where that's abuse.
Yes.
I mean, people are absolutely being abused by these diseases that need to be cured. I mean, that's
right.
all there is to it. Because I know my dad as an example. When he was the last nine, I say the last 9 years of his life is when he went through his dementia and Alzheimer's, and the last 9 months of his life were just pure hell for him. And in hospitals in and out, care centers, and looking for group homes and whatever else where he could be cared for. And then the last 9 days of his life was very nice because he spent 9 days in peace in a hospice. So I guess it's all's well that ends well in some respects like that. But boy, I tell you, I know that man felt terribly abused, and it was no fault of anybody's, and it was no fault of his.
Right.
And he was not a happy camper. And I have similar situations with my mother, not to the degree my dad was.
Right.
She's not there yet, but there's similar situations there too.
Well, and when you see that, it gives you a wake-up call for yourself because you know, you turn around and look and say, well, you know, who's going to be there to champion for me? And that's very difficult.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, let's finish on a little different note here as we're starting to get down to the short rows. I have this note here that says you've been involved in some high-end financial investigations where the losses or judgment are 6 to 7 figures. That's a lot of money. What have you done and how have you been involved with this? You do it on a national and an international basis, so you're all over the place. And you mentioned Bernie Madoff also in here. Did you have anything to do with any of that at all?
Well, what we do is we work for behalf of the victims to recover funds on their behalf in those types of cases or Ponzi cases. And the Madoff case is one of them. The Stanford case out of Texas that recently made headlines because he was just recently convicted of 13 of 14 counts and facing 20 years on each count. In that essence, what they were doing was they had a bank in Antigua. They were promising higher returns than normal on CDs, and he, in essence, had the bank examiner for Antigua in his back pocket, so they got a clean bill of health every time they were examined. And then Mr. Stanford and about four or five of his cronies were the ones that were pillaging the bank for their own personal piggy bank to some degree. And there's about 30,000, I guess, of his slant victims that were lost money for this. And then what we do is we locate money, like I said, on their behalf, and because a lot of times the money's moved overseas on those types of situations. And it's, you know, you have everybody from across the board as far as victims. And so if somebody is a victim of a Ponzi scheme like that, we would be happy to talk to them. I'm not at liberty to say directly whether we helped anybody within that was a victim as far as the Madoff case or some of the others because of the privacy acts. But, the help is available. And it's a bit different in the fact that we're working for directly for individuals.
The individual that was...
Right, the victim.
That was wronged.
Right, right.
Do you... How often do people get anything back in those kinds of operations?
Quite often they get a lot back. It just depends on...
Really?
It depends on who's doing... What I'm saying is that the easiest way to put this, it depends on who's doing the searching for the assets, whether it is the government that's doing it or whether it's the private sector that's doing it. We are considered private sector. Therefore, we're able to operate at a quicker pace than, say, what the government operates.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a determining factor, a deeming factor, is because a lot of times, when the money's moved overseas, then it's moved four or five times after that. And in some cases, like with Madoff's case, it took the government a year in regards to going after and looking for assets and trying to locate them. And, you know, after a year's time, where you find that the money was is that it's five times down the road and places that you don't even know about.
And I would imagine as a private investigator, you don't really have to telegraph things like the government does.
That's true.
I mean, the government, you know, has to lay groundwork and has to do all this kind of stuff, and you could just sniff it out and move where the trail takes you.
Right.
And you don't have to be quite as cognizant of other relations that would involve the government, positive or negative. You can just go do your thing.
Right, and everything that we do is done legally and by the book in reference to working with attorneys and that type of thing. But as far as actually searching out the trail and tracking where the things have gone, that's our business because the fact that we're being retained privately by the client and the results that we get go to the client.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, this has certainly been an interesting conversation that I've had with you today, Mike. I do appreciate you taking the time from your busy work schedule to spend it with me today. If anybody has any need for your services, whether it be in fraud investigations, I would imagine, or adoption, certainly, or dealing with elder abuse type situations, any of those types of things where a private investigator could be of benefit, how can they get hold of you?
Well, they can go to the website, which is www.missinginc.com, and then they can also email me at missinginc@msn.com.
And you of course, will do everything in confidentiality and
yes.
Let them know whether or not there is or isn't room for your services and whether it's something that they need to possibly pursue in a different manner other than maybe even through your services. I imagine there are some things that you just don't deal with.
That's true. And I usually will talk to them for free to begin with to see if I can even be of help to them before I take them on as a client. And if I can't, then I will go the extra mile to make sure that they either understand why or see if I can refer them to somebody that can.
And that was going to be my next question. Then you do refer to people that this may or may not be your specialty, or may be something that you don't have the time for at that particular point in your other investigation. So you will refer to other people.
Yes, I will. Because for instance, I don't do domestics or surveillance. I've chosen not to do domestics, and so I have a handful of investigators I do referrals to, and I realize that there's divorces and problems in marriages, and I understand that, but it's just not an area that I choose to want to go into.
Well, it's probably a good area not to go into based on everything that happens when the police even go out on a domestic abuse call or something like that. There's all kinds of problems that get involved there. And congratulations. I think we'll help your longevity if you don't do those types of cases.
Well, that's good in that respect with it. And your situation with you and the babe, we don't have to worry about that, right?
If you do, it's news to me. Well, maybe I should have you check it out just to be safe. But you don't do domestic, so we're not going to worry about that. No, everything's fine with me and the babe. Geez, how we deteriorate sometimes on these conversations on the Boomer the Babe show. Before you know it, I'm spilling my life story here and people... What's wrong with that man?
Right.
Well, Mike, again, thank you very much for being our guest today, my guest today. I want to get in touch with you after the show here very shortly, and there's something that I want to talk to you about offline, which is nothing to do with private investigations.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you to do me a favor, if you don't mind, with regard to our new online magazine. So,
all right.
We'll talk about that very shortly. And again, thank you very much. Why don't you go ahead and give us your website information one more time.
It's www.missinginc.com, and the email address is missinginc, and again, it's INC, but it's missinginc@msn.com.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate
thank
your
you.
Time. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and nice getting to know you on the phone.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it, and we'll be in touch.
You bet. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank everybody for listening to us today on the Boomer the Bay Show. We always try to give you something to think about, and I think we did that today with Mike Kiger from MissingInc.com. You have been listening to the Boomer the Bay Show here on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world, and I think we had a pretty good conversation today. Remember that the Boomer the Babe does much more than just this radio show. We also do ebooks and mini books. Many of our ebook authors are also having their own shows on Blog Talk Radio here on the Boomer the Babe Network. And we have a new show starting up this afternoon that Deborah will be doing with Dr. Kobayeva, and it's all about global. Going global, my gosh, I'm getting my tongue tied here. They're going global fast with Dr. Tayara Kobayeva and Deborah Brown this afternoon at 12 o'clock West Coast time. So remember to listen to the Boomer the Babe Show for good information, a good conversation. Make the second half of your life the best half of your life. And we'll see you at 12 o'clock this afternoon with Dr. Kobayeva. Have a great day, everybody.
Listening to the Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.